Welcome to New Books in American Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Matt Johnson, and I'm here today with Tayshaun Lattner, a professor of history at Thomas Jefferson University, to talk about his book, Cuban Revolution in America, Havana and the Making of the United States Left, 1968 to 1992. Tayshaun, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So why don't we start just by asking, what sparked this really great book about American leftists traveling to Cuba?
Sure. So, long before I was an academic, I was a political activist. And, one of the issues that I was engaged with back in the late 1990s and early 2000s was U.S. foreign policy, and specifically U.S. foreign policy toward Cuba. And so actually the very first time that I became involved with Cuba was actually not as an academic. It was as an intern working for Global Exchange in San Francisco, which is a human rights organization that, among other things at that time, hosted travel trips to Cuba that allowed U.S. citizens to travel to and evaluate and witness and experience Cuban society for the first time. So that was back in 1998. The first time that I traveled to Cuba after being involved with it for several years was in 2004 as a member of the Vincent Amos Brigade, which of course is one of the organizations that whose origins I profile in the book. And as a result of that experience, I became interested in thinking about the role and the place of Cuba within the American radical imaginary, and thinking about the salience of Cuba's revolution for generations of activists in the United States that have been working for various social changes that American activists and leftists perceived as having been instituted already in Cuba.
Yeah, but you write that Cuba remained the most consistent influence on left-wing radicalism in the United States. Why do you think Cuba has been so influential?
I think there's a variety of reasons. I mean, I think one of the reasons is the sheer durability of Cuba's revolution, that Cuba had persisted for years and then decades. And so there were other third world revolutions or left-wing or socialist governments that had been inspirational to U.S. leftists and U.S. social movements, but that had succumbed to right-wing coups or other developments. So the government of Alcobar Arbenz in Guatemala comes to mind, which was, of course, overthrown in a CIA-backed coup. There's also the government of Salvador Allende in Chile, which also succumbed to a similar coup in the early 1970s. So Cuba is an enormously durable example of left-wing social change for U.S. leftists. But I think that it goes much farther than simply durability. I think that Cuba, as a revolutionary society that had tried to enshrine ideas like universal education, universal healthcare, subsidized food and housing as universal human rights, that was enormously powerful as an example for a lot of U.S. leftists who were fighting for similar changes in the United States. Recall, of course, that this is the 1960s. This is the era of the Great Society and the War on Poverty, in which support for those kinds of social programs of a robust social safety net in which no citizens, no human beings are left behind was, enjoyed widespread support, or at least wider support in the United States than it did certainly in, by the 1970s and 1980s. So there's the domestic aspect of it, but there's also the global part of it as well. In Cuba, upon achieving a successful revolution in 1959, January 1st, almost immediately began lending its aid, both material and rhetorical, to left-wing and socialist and anti-imperialist movements and governments in the Third World, one of the earliest being, of course, Algeria, which was in the midst of an armed insurgency against French colonization. And throughout the years, Cuba aided a number of left-wing or anti-imperialist movements that played a role within American political culture. The obvious one, of course, is Vietnam in the late 1960s, of course. The war in Vietnam became a significant issue within the United States, and Cuba's aid was significant and and consequential. I mean, at the time, actually in the late 1960s, that there was a milk shortage in Cuba. For instance, Cuba was sending tons of its own milk and other products products to Vietnam to aid the Vietnamese liberation forces. And so this was, you know, perceived in the United States as a, you know, daring act in solidarity with Vietnam. And, you know, the support for, or rather opposition to the Vietnam War in the United States took a variety of forms. And not all of those forms were simply opposition to the war itself. Some U.S. leftists actually took the side of the North Vietnamese insurgents and, you know, wished them victory. And so Cuba's aid was seen as, you know, bold and daring and very important. By the 1970s, Cuba had become involved in aiding anti-colonial and anti-racist movements actually throughout the African continent, but most importantly, in southern Africa. In the mid-1970s, Cuba was aiding the struggle in Angola. And that struggle actually was one of the factors that prompted the downfall of the apartheid regime in South Africa. And so that was also perceived within the United States as well. So, yeah, I mean, there's this sort of matrix, there's this confluence of factors that are both domestic in the United States, in which people are perceiving Cuban society as instituting social changes and social structures that they wanted to institute within the United States. And there's also Cuba's foreign policy, which, you know, has, it, as it's often been said, right, Cuba is a small so-called third world nation, but has had the foreign policy of a large, a powerful nation.
Yeah, you write a bit about how Americans are really, these activists who are traveling to Cuba are really attracted to this, you know, third world variant of Marxism. And since, you know, a lot of our listeners might not know what that actually means, I was wondering if you kind of explain that to listeners a little bit. You know, what is this third world variant of Marxism, and why are these activists really attracted to that in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, so in a nutshell, I mean, traditional Marxism, I guess, conceptualized the engine of social change, the engine of revolutionary transformation as the industrial proletariat, the industrial working class. And so China's revolution had presented an alternative that the, you know, rural peasantry, you know, could be revolutionary agents of change and, you know, could participate in revolutionary struggle. By the time that Cuba's revolution, you know, gained steam in the late 1950s, it, you know, was apparent that the that, you know, Cuban rural workers and farmers and peasants were playing a significant role. And so I think that, you know, I think that precedent was not necessarily perceived as especially relevant to people, you know, in the United States, but, you know, in terms of their own political movements. But what it did was sort of announce that Cuba's revolution would be different, that it would be sort of embedded within third world revolutionary traditions and, you know, seemingly embedded within Marxism, although that was not avowed by the Cuban revolutionary leadership until the Bay of Pigs invasion, when actually just a short time before that, Fidel Castro announced or admitted, depending on who you're talking to, the, you know, socialist and Marxist character of the revolution. But so these things, you know, meant that Cuba's revolution was perceived as left-wing, was perceived as, you know, within the socialist camp, but was different. And this was important to a lot of U.S. leftists who, you know, were open to ideas of socialism and left-wing radicalism, but were, of course, enormously disillusioned with the Soviet Union and its, you know, sort of shadow of totalitarianism and death camps. And so Cuba, although it found itself within the Soviet camp after 1961 as a self-defensive measure against U.S. Pressure and aggression, that Cuba always was, you know, perceived as being, you know, as being different.
Mm-hmm. And so you start this book talking about this organization that you've already mentioned, the Mensa Ramos Brigade. You know, what was this organization about, and what brought them to Cuba?
So the Mensa Ramos Brigade was formed by, you know, elements of the anti-war movement in the United States, especially SDS, Students for a Democratic Society. And at this time, this was sort of late 1968, the Vietnam War was at its height, but there was perceived within U.S. movements was a sort of a little bit of a lack of direction in terms of what to do with this new energy that was being generated within the U.S. left. And so in the words of some of the organizers of the Vincent Ambus Brigade, they wanted to create what they called a so-called foreign policy of the U.S. left. They wanted to bring this energy, this sort of left-wing vibrance within U.S. society and focus it abroad, not just within the United States. But the Vincent Ambus Brigade was also initially conceptualized as a way to consolidate U.S. support for the Cuban Revolution, but more importantly, give Americans who were interested in Cuban society a way to witness the nature of Cuban society and culture for themselves. Cuba at that time was under a U.S. travel ban. U.S. citizens were prohibited by law from traveling to Cuba. And so perceptions of Cuban society were, of course, generated through coverage within the U.S. media, which, you know, the Vincent Ambus Brigade perceived justly as quite biased against Cuba and the Cuban Revolution.
Yeah, what's great about this book is that you get to talk a lot about the experience of these people who travel to Cuba, on the ground, right? And so it's this amazing amount of energy and hope, but also some disillusionment once they get on the island, right? So I was hoping you could talk a little bit about what their experience actually looked like in Cuba.
Yeah, so the Vincent Ambus Brigade's first two contingents, they were allowed to cut sugarcane actually on the island. So the Vincent Ambus Brigade, actually the initial idea with it was to aid Cuba's socialist development by freeing up labor within Cuba so that more Cubans could participate in the 1970 sugar harvest. So in 1970, the Cuban government and Cuban society mobilized for what they called the 10 million tons harvest, which was really an odd effort to harvest a sufficient amount of sugarcane to jumpstart the Cuban economy using what was at that time and what would remain for several decades, actually, the primary means of foreign exchange for the Cuban economy, which was, of course, sugar. And so in support of this goal, the Vincent Ambus Brigade wanted to send sympathetic U.S. volunteers to Cuba to aid in this effort in some way. And, you know, apparently, I mean, according to the activists that I interviewed, the kind of initial dream was to actually, you know, cut sugarcane along with the Cubans and also foreign solidarity delegations that were participating in this, and they were sort of too afraid to ask, right? Like the idea of Americans cutting sugarcane in Cuba was sort of imagined as an impossibility. But the official permission came from actually Fidel Castro himself, who said that they would be allowed to cut sugarcane, and so that was the nature of the first two brigades, was that several hundred American volunteers cut sugarcane in Cuba alongside Cuban workers, students, and volunteers, and also left-wing solidarity brigades and delegations from throughout the
world. Once the U.S. government figured out that, you know, some of these people are going to Cuba, how did they react?
Yeah, I mean, so it was greeted with, you know, enormous suspicion within the United States. The initial accusation was that Cuba was actually using the Vincent Ambus Brigades as an opportunity to train Americans in the art of guerrilla warfare, and this was, of course, emboldened by the fact that there were some U.S. leftists in the United States who were, using more than simply rhetorical calls for armed insurgency within the United States. So there were organizations like Students for a Democratic Society that had played a significant role in the anti-war movement. But their breakoff group, you know, the Weatherman organization, had actually used acts of political violence, including bombings, to try to, as they termed it, bring the war home and force the United States to end its incursion into Vietnam.
Yeah, and looking at some of those questions, you dive into the FBI records, right? And all scholars who really dive into those records face really difficult methodological questions about how to approach those documents. And you take this really unique look at these records, calling the FBI records as a state history of dissent. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So at the time that I was doing this research, there was really nothing substantive other than one very good journal article that had been written about the Vincent Amos Brigade. And so as I, you know, began to look for information about them, about the organization, one of the things that I learned immediately was that they had long been the object of suspicion by both the FBI and the CIA. And, you know, it was clear from early on that there was a large, you know, cache of materials, you know, that were FBI files. And so upon requesting them, I was told by the FBI that there were over 20,000 pages of documentation that the FBI had gathered on the brigade. And this, of course, was, you know, far larger than any of the university archives that I was, you know, consulting to try to get information about the brigade. And so, you know, many of the FBI agents that were involved in compiling these archives and these records were, you know, were engaging in, you know, historical and political analysis, some of it of high quality, some of it, let's say, you know, less high quality. But the, you know, the FBI agents were, you know, in many ways, in some cases, you know, acting like or trying to act like historians. They were, you know, making arguments. They were drawing conclusions according to the sources that they had. And so, you know, at this, you know, particular time when I was doing this research, the U.S. government and the FBI simply had by far the largest archive on this organization of anyone. And so this idea of a state archive, I mean, it was sort of a way to think about the way in which the FBI's gathering of information and documentation in this way was really became an archival process.
Yeah, my favorite chapter in this book is I rarely get to read about people hijacking planes. You have an entire chapter on U.S. citizens who hijack planes and fly them to Cuba. I mean, who are these people hijacking planes and flying them to Cuba?
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, sort of an episode in American political history that's not very well remembered today. But, you know, between 1968 and 1972, there were, you know, roughly 90 successful hijacking attempts, you know, from the United States to Cuba. And the people that were perpetrating these acts, you know, in many ways, they're very difficult to generalize. The people that I focus on were Americans that framed their actions in some way within tropes of protest, right? So they imagined their actions as acts of protest, either against the U.S. embargo against Cuba or you know, other political causes. And so, you know, one of the young men that I profile was a young protester, anti-war protester from the state of Washington, who you know, hijacked his plane to Cuba as an act of protest against the Vietnam War. With that said, most of the hijackers, at least in Cuba, were perceived as mentally unstable, were perceived as people that were politically opportunist, that they did not have, you know, sort of well-developed political analyses, and that they were, again, in Cuba, perceived as, you know, common criminals that were using this opportunity, meaning the ability of Americans to hijack planes to Cuba as an opportunity to, you know, to get away with crimes that, you know, had no real political merit.
And you write too about, you know, some of these concerns lead them to have a different experience than some of the other activists who come to Cuba. What was it like for them once they landed the plane in Cuba?
Yeah, so at that time, anyone who hijacked a plane to Cuba was immediately under suspicion of, you know, being a potential CIA agent, for instance, and they were, you know, quarantined within U.S. immigration or U.S. detention facilities, actually run through the Department of Immigration, and the Cuban government wanted to find out who they are and why they were coming to Cuba and whether they had, you know, legitimate reasons for seeking political asylum. And so there were some activists that, you know, made compelling cases that they were actually facing legitimate political persecution in the United States, or that they were facing crimes for which they would not receive fair political trials, you know, in the United States. What appears to have happened is that the Cuban government allowed almost all of these individuals to remain in Cuba and, you know, prove themselves as we could say, working members of Cuban society. And so they were detained for a period of days or weeks, or in actually one case, a year and a half within Cuban detention facilities. And then eventually they were allowed into a halfway house, which was dubbed Hijack House, in which they were sort of acclimated to Cuban society. They were allowed to take jobs. They were allowed to, you know, find, or in some cases were given, independent housing in Havana. And they were allowed to sort of integrate within Cuban society and sort of make their way under the evaluation of Cuban officials. And there were a number of these, especially those that were facing significant political charges or legal charges in the United States, that made long-term lives for themselves in Cuba. In the book, I write a lot about William Lee Brent, who was a member of the Black Panther Party, who was involved in a shootout with San Francisco police in 1969. And he, you know, had long perceived Cuba as a place that, you know, if anything happened, if he found himself under political persecution in the United States, that he, you know, might stand a chance of receiving formal political asylum. And in that case, that's what he received. I mean, he ended up getting a university degree at the University of Havana and ended up teaching teaching high school, actually, at Havana's most prestigious high school for almost 25 years. And, you know, there are others. I also write about a man named Charlie Hill, who was a member of the Republic of New Africa, who was involved in a shootout with a New Mexico state trooper in outside Albuquerque in the early 1970s. And with two other comrades, he hijacked a plane to Havana and was detained. But the three of them, made a compelling case that they were legitimate political refugees, that they, you know, made the case that they had been attacked by this police officer, and that they, that they killed the police officer in self-defense, and that they would not have received a fair trial in New Mexico in the early 1970s. And, you know, all of them were allowed to make lives for themselves, in Cuba.
And you find this really surprising diplomatic story that comes out of all these hijackings, where you kind of argue that, that these hijackings brought the U.S. and Cuban governments into a dialogue. And so, you know, how did that happen? What do these dialogues look like?
Yeah, so I mean, as a result of these hijackings between 1968 and 1972, both the Cuban and U.S. governments found themselves really in an untenable position. Cuba, you know, found itself, you know, having to deal with this you know, incursion of American hijackers, most of whom were, you know, really seen as undesirable. You know, in Cuba, they were seen as people who had, you know, political crime, who had committed crimes that had no real political merit. And on the U.S. side, the United States saw itself as having a law enforcement problem, in which there was, a series of hijackings occurring that was actually the highest rate of hijackings that had occurred anywhere, anywhere in the world, during the era of global, air transportation. So both governments, finding themselves in, a difficult predicament, were forced to do something really extraordinary for the United States and Cuba in the early 1970s, and that was talk to each other, or at least talk to each other openly. The two governments had been, as we now know from some, excellent scholarship that's been done on this, the two governments had been actually in secret communications or secret negotiations for, for quite a long time, actually since the very beginning of the severing of U.S.-Cuba relations. But the hijacking episode between 1968 and 1972 forced both governments to do this openly and forced them to do this in a substantive way. And so in 1973, both governments signed an agreement to at least attempt to end hijacking from the United States to Cuba. It bears mentioning that the United States actually found itself at a disadvantage within these negotiations, that for many years it was the United States that had you know, sort of been the target of hijackings from Cuba to the United States by Cubans that were disaffected by the Cuban Revolution, that perceived themselves as political refugees from communism, and that these hijackers from Cuba to the United States certainly had not been returned to Cuba by the United States, nor had the aircraft been returned, and nor had the watercraft been returned if they, you know, hijacked. If the hijackings were, you know, boat hijackings and not air hijackings. And so in this situation in which the United States had not acted with reciprocity, in which the United States had not, you know, honored Cuba's request to return its property and its people that had committed hijacking crimes, the United States now found itself in a position where it was demanding the same of Cuba. So the United States was demanding something of Cuba that it had not done itself. And so in this sense, you know, the United States, negotiated with Cuba, but was in, was in a weak position.
And you move on from there to start talking about the Maceo Brigade. And in that chapter, you have this really interesting discussion that I want to highlight, where you start writing about just the political minefield all scholars writing about Cuba really enter into. And so I wanted you to talk a bit about what that political minefield looks like and how you navigate that when you're writing about Cuba.
Yeah, so Cuba studies and Cuban history, particularly within the United States, is, you know, an intensely polarized field. For a variety of different reasons. I mean, U.S.-Cuba relations has, you know, in a reoccurrent way been at the center of U.S. foreign policy, you know, since the 1960s. It's also a field that's characterized by intense emotions because of the large communities of Cuban Americans who have emigrated to the United States since the 1959 Cuban Revolution, and that in many ways, political discourse on Cuba and knowledge of Cuba within the U.S. public has in some way been filtered through the political perspectives of Cuban American communities. And so it is, a field within academia that's characterized by, you know, intense emotion. And so it, you know, it's often perceived as, you know, difficult to produce scholarship on Cuba that is, you know, divorced from, you know, one's, political ideologies.
I wanted to bring out a bit, you travel to Cuba a lot for this book, and the book is based on just so many interviews, and you end the book, you know, writing about political asylum, which is largely based on these interviews too. I was wondering if you talk a bit about just how many interviews you did and how you tracked down all of these people.
Yeah. So, there are three, there are three U.S. political exiles who are, you know, currently in Cuba, who I pay a lot of attention to in the book. And they are, of course, Charlie Hill, who was a member of the Republic of New Africa. There is Nahanda Biodun, who was a member of the Black Liberation Army. And there is Asada Shakur, who was a member of the Black Panther Party and then a member of the Black Liberation Army as well. When I began doing this research in Cuba in 2012, Asada Shakur was effectively underground within Cuba. She was protected, directly by the Cuban government as a result of being the target of a $2 million extradition bounty leveled by both the FBI and the state of New Jersey. So when I was doing the research for this book, Asada Shakur was effectively uncontactable. And so doing the research on her necessitated that I speak with people that knew her. So, you know, her friends and her comrades. So the first, one of those people was Charlie Hill. Charlie Hill, of all the political exiles in Cuba, I think, certainly in the last 25 years, I mean, he has been one of the most accessible to U.S. journalists. And so, he's been interviewed by, you know, dozens and dozens of U.S. journalists and academics over the years. When I went to Cuba, in a research capacity for the first time in 2012, however, I didn't know how to contact him. And so I had heard that he, you know, often hung out at a particular park in Havana where he would try to find U.S. or English-speaking tourists that, you know, might be in need of a well-informed tour guide who could, you know, show them things in Havana that, you know, they might not find on their own. And so knowing that he, you know, might be at this park, I showed up there and you know, began asking, you know, people in the park, Cubans in the park, you know, whether or not they, you know, knew of Charlie Hill. And, you know, I introduced him as someone who was a member of the Black Panther Party, which is, of course, not true. He was a member of the Republic of New Africa. But the Black Panther Party was and is very well known in Cuba. And the sort of the idea of the Black Panther Party in Cuba has kind of become a stand-in for U.S. Black liberation and Black radical movements. And so I, you know, after a couple of days of asking around, I was able to, you know, to find a man who said, yes, you know, I actually do know Charlie Hill. And, you know, this man, you know, called him up and, you know, an hour later, Charlie Hill was, you know, was in the park. So Charlie was, you know, useful in, you know, helping me understand the realities of, you know, some of the U.S. political exiles that I was not able to contact. I also spent a lot of time interviewing and you know, sort of using the research assistance of a number of Cubans that knew and know very well the U.S. political exiles in Cuba. And the U.S. political exile that I perhaps know best and spent the most time with and the most interview time with was Nahande Abiodun, who came to Cuba in 1990, who is accused of, among other things, participating in the prison liberation of Assad Shakur.
Yeah, so, I mean, you cover a big time period in this book from 68 to 92. I mean, when you look at that time period, what do you think are the biggest outcomes or the biggest legacies of all of these travels to Cuba?
It's a really good question. I mean, in the you know, the chapter that I write about the Vincent Amos Brigade, I try to get at that at the end of the chapter, and I try to kind of think of the trajectory of the Vincent Amos Brigade as a internationalist, transnational, left-wing Cuba solidarity organization that began in 1969, but actually continues to this day. And so, you know, the Vincent Amos Brigade was important in that it introduced generations of U.S. leftists to Cuba in a principled manner, that it allowed American left-wing activists to travel to Cuba to meet Cuban revolutionaries and also representatives of other left-wing and anti-imperialist movements who were, you know, in Cuba and in Havana at that time. And, you know, these experiences were enormously radicalizing for a lot of Americans that traveled to Cuba with the brigade. And, it, you know, I think one of the things that I noticed when interviewing former members of the Vincent Amos Brigade is that no one had emerged from their travels to Cuba unchanged, that this had been an enormously significant political awakening for them, that they were, you know, in some senses, you know, never really the same, you know, afterward. And so what we find, you know, when, you know, studying, you know, social movements within the United States in the 1970s and 1980s and 1990s is that we find, you know, alumni, so to speak, of the Vincent Amos Brigade almost everywhere, but particularly within the Latin American solidarity movements of the 1970s and 1980s, in which Americans tried to, intervene in and stop the threat of, you know, U.S. military intervention into Central America. I'm thinking particularly of El Salvador, but also Nicaragua in the late 1970s and early 1980s. There were and are a lot of former members of the Vincent Amos Brigade that became activists within the women's and feminist movements in the 1980s and 1990s. And within the kind of broadly conceived Black liberation and Black nationalist movements, including the remnants of the Black Panther Party. And so there was an article that was written in Z Magazine in the 1990s by Elizabeth Martinez, in which she talks about the Vincent Amos Brigade as being a pillar of the U.S. left, an organization whose ability to kind of to radicalize U.S. leftists had been significant, particularly in the way that we see the former members of the brigade really, you know, throughout the left. I mean, she says something to the effect of that, you know, wherever we see movement in the United States, wherever we see left-wing activity, wherever we see social justice movements, you know, we find, you know, in some way, eventually we will find, you know, alumni of the Vincent Amos Brigade.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an incredibly important chapter in American history. I'm glad you wrote this book. The book is Cuban Revolution in America. Tayshaun Lattner, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.